little jazz to get us going on Spectrum West this week, because the Big Eau Claire Jazz Festival begins next week. Hi, everybody. I'm Al Ross. It's 6.5 minutes after 5 o'clock. The march of summer continues. If you like Wisconsin apples, pray to keep a freeze away. And maple syrup. I might have to cut my grass in March, believe it or not. Thanks for putting us on your radio. Today, we're going to meet a young lady who comes from that Wisconsin boom town, Clintonville. She furthered her education at UW Stout and is now a respected sommelier. One who knows and loves wine makes her living taking care of the supply at a stylish Eastern resort. Jim Oliver is here to share a chat with an author who lives in Bloomer and who's just released the first of what is planned to be a series of mystery novels. We'll hear from the artist whose work was named Best of Show in the Arts West 33 exhibit now hanging at the Public Library in Eau Claire. But first, Ryan Jones teaches music history and music theory. Robert Baca teaches jazz studies and how to play. He's also the face behind so much of the extraordinary music to which we're treated throughout the year. Both UW Eau Claire tutors were kind enough to congregate for some trialogue in our studio. This time of year, it's the Eau Claire Jazz Festival, as I said, decades old and one of America's premier long-form events. Several days of concerts and talks and classes and socializing with a wonderful background. One of the highlights, and there are many, of this year's event is a several-block recreation of New York's famed 52nd Street, except it'll be Barstow Street in downtown Eau Claire doing the honors there. Is this something that you are going to have annually, or is this just this year's wrinkle?
This is something we'd like to have annually. As we've talked about before, Al, the educational part of the Jazz Festival takes place at the university, and we want to be able to have jazz activity that goes all throughout Eau Claire, not just represent music, but to represent all of the arts. We've already had activities, Jump, Jive, and Read for kids about jazz, and we have paintings where we have an art crawl, and one of our culmination events that we're having in our community is something called 52nd Street.
Yeah, so when the Jazz Fest activities and committee were getting rolling, Bob had suggested to me that I might tailor my talks at the library to this 52nd Street theme. And so that's what I did. So 52nd Street itself, it refers to one block on 52nd Street between 5th and 6th Avenues in New York. Okay. And so all of these clubs, sort of this in its heyday in the 1930s and early 1940s, really there was probably 7 or 8 jazz venues or popular music venues that would have been around, like the Three Deuces or the Onyx or the Famous Door, and various players from the day would have been performing there. So you had this collision of style, right, intersecting all the time, and players feeding off of each other from different styles, and also just audiences moving in and out of clubs, you know, on the same evening and hearing different players. The street transformed over time, going from speakeasies to jazz clubs and eventually into strip joints, and then its liquor license being withheld by 1960. And so that was sort of the end of the street. And then there was, you know, construction. If you go to 52nd Street today, all you'll see is skyscrapers. We actually have photos from the street in its heyday, and you can see artists' names, you know, Billy Eckstein or, you know, Coleman Hawkins. And so I've selected some of my favorite artists who would have been on the street and that we knew were on the street throughout that decade or so. It's basically an excuse to talk about these great artists when you would never otherwise collect them together because they are so different stylistically.
You've made that presentation at the library in Eau Claire already, but is that going to be there during the presentation of 52nd Street itself?
There won't be any formal lectures or any format like that, but the idea is that the Jazz Fest itself is sort of taking over Barstow Street downtown, I think across 2 blocks maybe of different sites, and where jazz is supposed to be happening, well, all these simultaneities. You know, you have all of these different activities all at the same time. So
52nd Street was for audiences to be able to hear all kinds of jazz in one setting, and they would go in for a half hour, and they would hear one group, and then they would walk across the street and they would hear another group. And at any one particular time, they might hear Louis Armstrong playing, and then they could go across the street and they might hear Miles Davis, and they might hear Charlie Parker, and they might – all of these great jazz artists. So what we've done with our 52nd Street, which goes from Acoustic Cafe down to the State Theater or Obsession Chocolates, is we want to be able to display as much as possible the great jazz talent. And like we have in our slogans, it's all jazz. And so there's every type of music that's going to be down there. And so folks can come to the big concerts, which will be at Memorial Auditorium, and they can hear John Patitucci, one of the world's most famous jazz bassists. You'll hear things you've never heard played on bass before. And Andy Martin, one of the top L.A. studio trombone players, in a setting of 1,000 to 1,200 to 1,500 people where you're hearing jazz artists on stage, and then go down to 52nd Street or Barstow and Eau Claire and be right up close with musicians, 2, 3, 4, 5 feet away, and be able to hear It's All Jazz, to be able to hear blues, to be able to hear we have two big bands that are playing, to be able to hear standards, to be able to hear a bop bebop combo, to be able to hear a modern jazz group, to be able to hear indie music. And it'll all be playing at the same time. It starts actually at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and goes until 2 o'clock in the morning, with probably the heyday of it being from about 10 until 11:30. We have 23 different local groups that'll be performing.
Do you have a list of venues up and down the street?
We do, and it's in all of our publicity that you'll be seeing everywhere.
But check online, the website.
Check online as well.
It's also probably worth pointing out, too, that the businesses downtown hopefully are benefiting from the foot traffic. And
sure.
One plug I might put out there is for Revival Records, a record store that sells vinyl mostly on the downtown area. So hopefully if people are liking what they're hearing, they can go explore further and actually go buy some music.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, it's not just – and actually for the audiences as well. It's also for the musicians. And we're adapting that as well, because on 52nd Street, all the jazz musicians would go down there as well, and they'd sit in and they'd play. And they'd bring their instrument. And so most of the groups that we have will have an open jam session. So you'll if you look at the schedule, you'll see what they're going to be doing for the first part of their set. And then they'll open up for an open jam session, and you'll hear musicians sit in. I think that's going to be the greatest and most spontaneous part, I think, of each group that's playing.
Yeah, and conversations I've had with musicians, it was always that point in their lives when they realized that they could sit down and play with anybody. That was the turning point for them. And I would think that young musicians playing at the university, they get to that point.
All the 23 groups, when they're done with their sets, they're going to be going across to, you know, we have a Dirty Dozen type Dixieland band with the tuba, and it's called the Water Street Brass Band. And I would say most, but I'd like to say almost all, the talent that I know of in this area is all going to be in this two-block area. So it would be something that if you look at Eau Claire, Wisconsin, from far away, this is going to show all the rich heritage that happens all in one night.
Well, you might start something. Who knows? Maybe 50 years from now, they'll say Barstow Street in Eau Claire. That's where it happened, man.
In New York.
Yeah, well, John and I were talking about the difference, and I, just as we were talking, asked him the difference, because I guess I didn't know. What was the difference between West Coast music and East Coast music? And, you know, he went on to explain a little bit of that, but interestingly enough, he said, but you still can't beat New York. He said, that's where everybody just comes to play.
That's where the history is.
Yeah.
You know, there was a saying from musicians that says, if you want something to swing as hard as it could possibly swing, get New York musicians. And if you want to have something swing as hard as it could possibly swing and be able to play everything else, get LA musicians. But the history is in New York, because there are still many people that were there in the 30s and 40s.
So, Ryan, teaching music history, is this kind of cool for you to be able to do? I mean, is 52nd Street a mecca that you literally talk about in your curriculum of music history?
I mean, it's more structured than 52nd Street. 52nd Street is more chaotic in a sense, and that's what's cool about it. So it comes up as a location of jazz. I mean, we talk about city centers in jazz history. You know, New York is only the most recent city center. Of course, things start in New Orleans and then progress to Chicago in the 20s a little bit with the Great Migration from the South, and then Kansas City is important for a while, and then finally New York really does become the center with bebop and other styles that develop right at the tail end of the street's heyday, which is probably the early 1940s. And so, and it still remains that way today, as we were saying. I think New York is where you have to go if you want to make that impression. Yeah, no, it's great to be able to be involved with the Jazz Fest and be able to help inform the audiences before they go and sort of have that context on a yearly basis. And more people seem to be turning out for these talks, and it's great, that they're getting that context.
Well, and that brings music 360 degrees when people know where it came from and why people did what they did. More and more music aggregations are holding talks prior to their performances so that people can, symphonies and everybody are doing that. So.
Program notes.
Yeah, so that's good stuff. What else?
For what's happening on the 52nd Street in downtown Eau Claire and Barstow Street, and that'll be on Friday, March 29th. So come down and have something to eat at a restaurant down there starting at 5 o'clock. Catch some dinner. If you're really into it, you can stay down there, as there'll be groups that'll be playing all night at these different venues. For many, they'll want to go to the big concerts, and that will be at 7:30 on Friday and 7 o'clock on Saturday night at Memorial High School. And that'll go till about 10 o'clock or 10:30. That's when the crest comes for 52nd Street. Go catch all these different clubs, and there's a student open jam session and then also an adult open jam session where we hope all the musicians are going to culminate to, and that's at the Stone's Throw. That goes till about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. There's a lot of surprises that they'll see down on 52nd Street, too, that have to do with other parts of the arts, but I can't let those out just yet. It'll be a great time, that's all I can say. A great time.
And I can't think of a better quote with which to leave you on that topic. The Eau Claire Jazz Festival, imaginative, fun, entertaining, fun, educational, fun. And if you miss it, you'll have to wait a whole year for it to roll around again. There's a lot going on, and all the info you need to take in as much as you can in the 4 days of the actual music making is available at EauClaireJazz.com.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering online and phone loan applications for student loans, consolidation, vehicles, a line of credit, and more. Information online at wisconsincu.org.
This is Spectrum West, and thanks for joining us today. As the submission deadline neared for the Big Arts West 33 exhibit, we talked with juror Peter Spooner late last year. The deadline passed, he went about his work, and then Arts West became a reality. It currently hangs at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. From 175 entries by 99 artists, 58 works were selected, representing 55 artists. One of those artists is Carol Adelman, and her collage Storm to the North was chosen Best of Show. Who is Carol Adelman? Well, she lives in luck, and it's hard work and imagination more than good fortune that has shaped her career.
I grew up in the St. Cloud area in Minnesota.
Okay.
And then my husband and I lived in Minneapolis, 30-plus years, and then we moved here in 1997 when he retired. He was a teacher. Both his parents grew up in luck.
You have received some fairly nice recognition as an artist. What's your history as an artist? And were you educated in art?
No, I was not. I was elementary ed major in college and did that for a few years. And quite a few years back in the 70s, I started doing weaving and was involved with making wall hangings and sold some in some shows and so on. And then I went to doing quilting and was very active in quilting and still occasionally make quilts, some traditional and some art quilts. And then I got into, more collage and this alternative photography of cyanotype, which I still dabble in.
Tell me more about that cyanotype.
It's a very old technology. It goes back to, 1840s in England, and it's very low-tech.
Ah.
I guess that's why I was drawn to it, because it was something I could do. I could get the materials. I'm not a high-tech person at all. It's a matter of two chemicals that you mix with water, and then you combine the two and put this on either paper or fabric, which I have done more of, and then print it in the sun. So you have your dried paper or fabric with the chemicals on it, put glass on it, and just bring it out to the sun and expose it for about 10 minutes and bring it in and rinse it off, and you're left with a print, blue.
Oh, really?
Although I paint dyes on fabric, too. Lots of colors, and then put the blueprint solution on that and print that, and then you're left with a little bit different look cut up the fabrics and use them as I wish.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I mean, cyan is one of the primary colors.
Mm-hmm.
Are there processes that involve other colors too, or is this something that just
there are? I have just never bothered to look into them. I just haven't run out of things I want to do with blue. Also, because where we live here, we're out in the country. I don't have. I guess I could order online and so on the other things, but I don't have people I could sort of work with to help me along on something new too.
Mm-hmm.
I used to do some workshops at quilt shows and things, but haven't done that for a long time.
Back to the process. You have a photograph?
Well, you can do it with photographs or with other things that act as a photographic negative. What I have done sometimes is take old photographs back from 100 years ago, these wonderful old portraits. The quality was so good, and I have made transparencies or negatives using those old photographs and then printed those to lay the negative onto this dried, treated fabric or paper and print that. And you can also use other things. You can use leaves. Then another way I use that process is to manipulate, like the treated fabric, I would scrunch it up, and so I'm basically printing shadows, and I have done that a lot. And you never know what you're going to get, so I just get the fabric ready, and it'll hang around for a while, and then I'll pull it out, see what I want to do. And I've also blueprinted a lot of stripes, and I use that in my work a lot, blue and white stripes, or blue and whatever color I have printed it on. And to do the stripes, I just take strips of black paper, lay it on there, and print that.
The process you were talking about a moment ago reminded me of tie-dyeing, when you crumple
sometimes
it up.
It looks like that.
Crumple
back
it up.
The 70s.
Our guest is Carol Edelman, and she lives in Luck, Wisconsin. She has the distinction of having her piece of artwork called Storm of the North being named Best of Show in the Arts West 33 show, which is up currently at the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. Describe, if you will. Now, as I told you earlier when we talked, I was going to go to the library to look at it, and then I thought, well, no, you know, it would be nice to have the perspective of someone who's listening to the radio who hasn't seen it yet.
Sure.
And I can go later on. So now your job, Carol, is to entice me to go see it by telling me what it's like.
Yes, it has bits of vintage fabric, some bits of newer fabric. It's on canvas, stretch canvas background. It really reflects the time and the place. I made it 1 year ago, and as you may remember, we had this horribly long winter.
Mm-hmm.
It's go on forever. And this is all about describing what it was like here late in the winter. I live in the woods, basically, and so it really incorporated that feeling to me. It was one of three in a series. The other one was called, I can't remember, it was the first one, but it was called Promise Me Flowers. And it had this similar kind of the gray, off-white, late winter feel, but I had a little bit of flowered fabric in there. And then the third piece in this series was called Snow and Earth. And it's where you get the bits of snow left in the woods, and there's the leaves and so on, kind of an organic feel to it, I guess.
Oh, sure. Well, of course, if we go to take a look at this piece, we can just thumb our noses at it because, you know, we're not feeling any
beautiful
of that. So this actually was broadcasting how you felt about last year's winter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
I don't realize these things until after a piece is done, and I think, well, of course, you know, that's where it came from.
Sure. Yeah, that's got to be interesting for an artist to do something just on how they're feeling and then take a look at it later on and say, wow, yeah, I remember how I felt that day. That's the power of artwork.
I think that's when I feel my work is most successful, when I'm maybe in the midst of it or something and I realize what it's about. And I just, you know, you just continue on doing what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
but at least you feel like it's all valid.
Yeah. You said that, and we talked about it earlier, that you had lived in the Twin Cities for a number of years. I talk to a lot of artists and find out that they decide that small town living is good for the soul. How has the transition, the culture shock, going from the Twin Cities to Luck, Wisconsin, and living in the woods, as you described it, how has that altered you or enhanced you as an artist?
Well, it was a big change for me because I had a group of friends that are artist friends, quilters and so on that I knew and saw in the Twin Cities. And I think there was something about the kind of the chaos of urban living that I sort of needed to jumpstart a lot of my work. And when we moved here, we built a house, and we were very involved with that for a few years. And I couldn't even find my materials for several years. But now I fortunately have a very nice large studio to work in. And we have been coming to this area, this woodsy lake area, for many years. And it just took a while to settle down and absorb all of that. And I feel very comfortable with it now. And there are some other artists living here, too. We have a local group called Earth Arts, and I associate with some of them. And so things are fine. They are having a tour the first weekend in May here in Polk County.
Back to that question, did you notice your artwork change at all from the time you lived in the city until the time you lived out in the boonies?
Not really. You just keep changing. If you keep working all the time, I've been doing this since the mid-70s in one way or another, and you just keep changing, and maybe it is more related to the outdoors now. Every day I look out the window and I see the woods and so on, and actually this winter I realized a whole bunch of these little collages I was doing had someone looking out the window to the woods. Mm-hmm. I've used a lot of old photos in my work lately in collages, and I could see this theme, and I thought it felt very much like a self-portrait to me.
Well, I noticed in doing a little bit of research about you that you have shown, you've garnered interest in places pretty far away, from Texas to Pennsylvania. How do you pick the kinds of places that you decide you're going to send your stuff to?
You know, nowadays you can look online and see many lists of opportunities for artists, and I look them over and I see if it's a show, an alternative photography show, I seem to have a piece that fits. Oh, I may send it off. Took me a while, and that was a big hurdle for me, was getting all the tech things, too. It used to be you sent in your slides, and I had a good photographer in the cities who I worked with. Well, then it had to be you sent everything online and so on, and CDs, and it took me a while to get that all figured out, but I think I have gotten that taken care of now. But I just look where something fits, and I there are a lot of photo shows and so on. I'm going to have work at Hudson Hospital this summer.
Yeah, that was going to be my final question, is where can people see more of Carol Adelman's work other than at the Arts West exhibit?
At Hudson Hospital, I'll have quite a few pieces. I'm going to be one of the featured artists, and that goes up mid-June and will be up for about 3 months. And I have some work in a local gallery here in Luck called Three Sisters. I have quite a few collages, smaller pieces there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a website yet. But
I'm glad you used the word yet. That would be nice. When we get it up, we'll let you know. Carol Adelman, Best of Show, Arts West 33, up through April 6th at the library. Coming up, Jim Oliver stops by to share a conversation with a Bloomer, Wisconsin author, and we'll talk wine with a Made in Wisconsin sommelier as Spectrum West continues after the news. Welcome back, everybody, to Spectrum West. For a Friday, the 23rd day of March, this is where Wisconsin comes to hear about and from the people who are making the art, the music, the literature, the theater, and a big difference in our lives by giving us cool things to do and see. Spectrum Memoranda. The Big River Radio Wave returns live at the Big River Theater in Alma, Sunday. Two shows, 4 and 6 p.m. That's going to be fun. Shell Lake Art Center and Theater in the Woods present the Jason Price Quartet in concert tomorrow evening at 7:30. Information at titw.org. Osseo Fairchild Schools present Hello Dolly next Thursday through Sunday. Evening shows Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, including a dinner show Saturday evening, and then a Sunday matinee at 2 p.m. It all happens in the Osseo Fairchild High School Auditorium. Tickets available at Hometown Market in Osseo and at the high school office. This weekend, the River Falls Area Chamber of Commerce and Tourism Bureau presents the second Bluegrass and Roots Festival in downtown River Falls. 3 days of bluegrass, roots, Cajun, and Americana. Complete schedule at www.riverfallsbluegrass.com. Also in River Falls, the UWRF Dance Theater Concert is Tuesday through Saturday next week, 7:30 p.m. show each day in Davis Theater at the Kleinpell Fine Arts Building. It all culminates in a 30-year dance theater reunion beginning at 4 p.m. next Saturday. Tickets available at the ticket office in the Fine Arts Building and at the door of each performance. Next Wednesday evening at 7:30, the Falcon's Nest at UW River Falls welcomes Noah Hain and his live looping show. It's part of the Wyman series, free and open to the public. That's us. Monday at the Public Library in Eau Claire, it's a poetry and prose reading, Writing Our Lives, a Women's History Month event featuring Bergeen Hakenson and Karen Loeb. It all begins at 7 p.m. Tonight at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls, it's Mu Daiko, Ritual Japanese Drumming, showtime at 7:30. And you can get tickets at the door for that. Well, Jim Oliver took the week off as it relates to his usual what's happening at the theaters. That's why I've been reading you a lot of stuff there. But he did not leave us empty-handed, thank goodness. He spent some time with another interesting and accomplished individual. And through the miracle of electronics, we share that encounter now.
Darren Kirby, a bloomer, has just published his first mystery novel set in the North Woods of Wisconsin. The title of the book is Coordinates for Murder. Darren Kirby joins us in the studio today to talk about his book and whatever else we can get him to talk about. Thanks for coming by.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So the book is labeled as a geocache mystery. What is geocache?
That's a really great question. Geocache is an international sport. Think of it kind of as a high-tech treasure hunt. You'll get a set of coordinates of where this geocache is for the most part. It's not military, type of accuracy, but you'll get these coordinates, go out and find the general area where it is. Once you find the cache itself, which could be a number of different things. Then you usually get to sign a logbook to say that you were there, and that's pretty much the fun of it.
Hmm. So there's some organizer of this who goes around and sets out these little messages here and there. And
you'd think that there'd be one sole person, but that person would be awfully busy since this goes on around the world. It's really done on kind of the grassroots level. Hmm. Anybody, you or I, could go out, set up our own geocache anywhere. And there's a couple of different websites that allow you to post where that is, and then everyone else has their opportunity to go and find that.
I take it you were a participant in this kind of activity then?
I have. My wife and I have done this occasionally. One of the last ones we did was up around Cornell. We went to the state park up there, and they've got a number of geocaches, and we had a lot of fun finding it, included our friends with us when they were camping as well.
Well, since this is labeled as a geocache mystery, is this the beginning of a series of books?
It is. This is obviously book number one, and I'm working on number two as we speak. It's churning away in my head, for better or for worse.
So what's the story about?
Story is there's two friends. They live in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and they like to go out and do geocaching and camping. Take an extended weekend, go up into the Shawamigan National Forest north of Hayward, and think they're going to find, do their usual kind of geocaching, go and find these caches throughout the weekend and have a good old time finding these. Unfortunately, what they end up with is somebody's kind of twisted idea of a joke. Uh-huh. Is what it ends up being.
Okay. So this is probably an obvious question, but anyway, I'll ask it anyway. Where did you get the idea for the story?
Kind of a number of places. Obviously, my wife and I love camping, so we like to be in the outdoors, and got interested in geocaching a number of years ago, just kind of as a fun little hobby, something else to do while we're out camping. And I also enjoy reading a lot, and I had never seen somebody put those elements together, and I thought, well, why not me? So I kind of came up with that as a general idea and started working around characters and plot around that, and this is where we end up with.
He is Darren Kirby, author of the geocache mystery coordinates for murder. You call this a mystery. I, having read the book, sounds more like a thriller to me, but I guess it's your book. You can call it what you want to.
It is primarily kind of a thriller, but there's a little bit of mystery element to it, mm-hmm. with the geocaches, not knowing where those will lead, what will happen with it. So it's kind of combines those two elements.
So what other writing have you done?
I've done a number of short stories. I've got one that's also published. I'm working on a second one, and I think I have a stack probably as tall as myself at home of different short stories that I've written over the years. So quite a few.
What got you interested in writing?
Wow, back when I was a teenager, I loved to read as far as I can remember. And I always kind of felt that it was something I've always wanted to do, but always kind of felt like it was something I wasn't qualified for. And then finally one day I thought, well, what makes them special? And come to find out, nothing really that I didn't already have. So I was kind of kicking myself, like, really, I waited this long to give this a try? But, you know, better late than never, as they say.
I'm always curious when I talk to authors, how long did this whole process take from starting the book until actually publishing it?
This probably took upwards of about a year between when I actually got the concept and started fleshing out the idea to finally getting it published. So but it was a fun ride along the way. Some, you know, fits and starts, but we ended up getting it through.
Now, you indicated there's another book in process. Do you have any ballpark idea of when that might be finished? When we can start looking for it?
I wish I could tell you that it would be out very soon. I know some people who've already read the first one have already queried me on the second one, when mm-hmm. that's coming out. So mm-hmm. Suffice it to say, it's not coming out as soon as I would like, but hopefully if I can get it done by the end of this year, otherwise early next year.
Mm-hmm. So where's the book available?
The book itself is available all of kind of the major online retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, mm-hmm. some of the smaller ebook retailers, and a print book is also presently available on Amazon and will be shortly on barnesandnoble.com as well.
So I take it you have a day job that you have to work around, and this, what is it you do to pay for your writing habit?
I do. Right now my day job is I'm a product manager with CMI Education here in Eau Claire. CMI is a national mental health seminar company. We put on trainings for the professionals around the country all year long.
Hmm. Well, we've been visiting with Darren Kirby, author of Coordinates for Murder, a geocache mystery, or like I prefer to call it a thriller. But anyway, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Festival Foods, introducing Amy Hanton, the cooking mom, a wife and mother who shares recipes, tips, stories, and cooking secrets. The Cooking Mom, festfoods.com.
Thank you, sir. It's 5:45, and this is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for joining us this week and every week that you can make it. We appreciate you being here. We appreciate your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Miracle Worker opens tonight at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. It will be performed through April 15th on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. as well as Sundays, April 1st and 15th at 2 p.m. Info and tickets at thephipps.org. Also next Saturday, the 31st, there's a jewelry making class. Next Saturday and Sunday, a mosaic workshop. Also at the Phipps. Enrollment and information at the website or by phone at 715-386-2305. The Eau Claire Children's Theater presents Seven Brides for Seven Brothers at the State Theater Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings next week and Sunday, April 1st at 1:30. Tickets at 839-8877 and at ecct.org. UW-Barron County Communiversity Symphonic Band presents their spring concert next Tuesday, the 27th at 7:30 p.m. in the UWBC Fine Arts Theater in Rice Lake. Tickets available at the door. UW Eau Claire Continuing Education is offering a summer writing camp for students entering grades 7 through 10. The camp is in June and features storytelling in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Also, there's a hands-on class called Discovering Ceramics coming in June. Registration and information at 836-3636 and the Continuing Education website. Fifth Annual Flyway Film Festival is open for entries, accepting short and feature-length films and narrative, documentary, and Wisconsin-Minnesota showcase. The deadline is in August. Information is at flywayfilmfestival.org. Lots on the Spectrum Memo today. Well, Brooke Sobel grew up in Clintonville, Wisconsin, home of the truckers and mysterious underground noises. She went to UW Stout to learn about the hospitality business, and that education provided a very pleasant surprise. It unveiled an aspect of it that she never thought of, the world of wine as a job, a career. Today, she's a respected sommelier, someone people turn to for advice and suggestions on how best to serve and enjoy the nectar of the gods. She is now wine director of the 90 Acres Culinary Center at Natterar. That's a posh resort in New Jersey's Somerset County, just west of New York City, co-founded by British entrepreneurial tycoon Sir Richard Branson. Long way to come from younger days in Wisconsin. Did you know as a young kid what a sommelier was?
No, I didn't. Ask me anything about beer, cheese, and football.
I wonder what the French word is for a connoisseur of beer.
There's actually a new program that has developed called the Cicerone Program. The great craft brews nowadays, the beer sommelier is really starting to be a designation amongst the food and beverage community.
You're in charge of all things wine at Natterar.
I am.
All right. That's a resort near New York. You are in New Jersey as we speak. I am curious, and I'll bet you a lot of the people out there listening are curious as well, to hear about an idea of your responsibilities there and what a typical day is, if there is such a thing.
Well, a typical day. Well, as I literally looking at 50 cases come walking in the door, a typical day consists of coming into the office, checking emails, seeing what's going on with various parties, tasting through wines, having meetings with vendors, meetings with winemakers. It all depends upon the day, depends upon the mood, what day of week.
Well, we've determined that you weren't set on this as a young child, but tell us when it was that you decided that this would be kind of cool to pursue.
Well, I was actually attending the University of Wisconsin-Stout for their hospitality and tourism management program, and I was born and raised on a golf course, and so I thought that that is what I had wanted to do. And so I was seeking corporate event planning with the PGA as a career.
Okay.
And I took a wine class in college. And quite honestly, I took this wine class because it was with one of my college roommates. The professor was amazing, very engaging, very passionate. And you also got to learn about alcohol.
Well, there you go.
And so we were tasting through various wines, and professor asked for me to stay after class, and I honestly thought it was because I had been drinking all of my roommate's wine and was getting a little loud, and he said to me, "Do you know you can pursue a career in wine? Your palate is unbelievable." And growing up in Wisconsin, I never knew that I could do this for a living. I never had wine on the table as a part of our lifestyle. I knew about beer, but I didn't know about wine.
Both beer and wine go well with cheese. How nice
Absolutely.
Is that? Yeah, well, I wanted to give a shout-out to Peter D'Souza, because if I remember correctly, we had him on at a time when the Packers were playing in the Super Bowl, and he had come out with a pretty cool menu for the Super Bowl.
Oh,
he's that kind
good.
Of guy.
And it was probably amazing and delicious, as everything that Peter touches, is you just want to eat it all.
It's mentioned that you have a down-to-earth approach to wine.
Yes.
What does that mean?
I'm not going to be one to tell you it smells like flowers and all of this.
Okay.
Frankly, do you like it or don't you? Because that's what's most important. I don't care about if you are drinking a $10 bottle or if you're drinking a $1,000 bottle. If you are enjoying it, if you're enjoying it with food, and if you're also enjoying it with the company, that is what matters to me.
That was the second part of that question. Your down-to-earth approach, is that meant to take the arrogance out of it? Because there
exactly.
are some people, yeah, there are some people that attach that word to wine.
They attach that word to wine and to sommeliers as a profession. You know, we're looked at as these nerds, so to speak, that have this amazing knowledge about the world and geology and geography and culture, food, chemistry. And if you can take that out of that equation, it's a fun job.
Oh, well, it sounds fun to me, I got to tell you. What about a guy that's enjoying a good old bottle of Boone's Farm?
Hey, I will have to say that we've all started at some point in time in our lives. And have I drank Boone's Farm? Yes. Have I drank White Zinfandel? Yes. Have I drank Yellowtail? Yes. Do I still occasionally drink PBR every now and then? Yes.
How about Blatz?
I have put down a few cans of Blatz, yes.
And Pabst Blue Ribbon is making a comeback. So is Schlitz, by the way. On the label it says classic 1960s formula. So pass that around, because at my age, I'm a connoisseur. We are talking with Brooke Sobel. She is a Wisconsin native, Stout grad in hospitality and tourism management, also studied wine and food pairing in Spain and Australia, now working in New Jersey. She recently made a trek back to Wisconsin. Tell us, Brooke, about the influence your Stout education made in your profession, because you've already sort of touched on it.
The influence.
Did it prepare you for all of the wonderful things that have happened to you?
Absolutely. It was amazing to go back and see many of the professors that I had, to see that they're still doing and teaching the same great thing. The influence that I had was, no matter what your position, you just get the job done. You do so with your head held high. You just work to do and get the job done.
Kind of sounds like people are delivering as we speak in the background.
Yes, 50 cases.
Wow. I haven't heard any bottles clinking. I thought that would be a familiar thing. But, of course, I guess they're padded well in those cases. Hey, you know what's cool is there are several vineyards cropping up around this part of Wisconsin. And I have a buddy that has a very well-known and successful vineyard on the coast of Oregon. And so they're popping up where they didn't used to be. Is that because new strains of grapes are being bred to flourish in new areas, or what's going on?
Absolutely. And everyone's getting more serious about their alcohol. One of my favorite beers and one of my favorite vodkas actually comes from Wisconsin. My favorite beer being Spotted Cow and Death's Door, some fantastic vodka coming out of Washington Island. It's getting back to great handcrafted spirits, whether it be spirits, beer, wine, anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Somebody just dropped a case, I think.
Somebody just ran into my desk.
Well, good. At least they didn't drop a case. The list of things you've done, Brooke, places you've gone, people you've met and worked with is impressive. What for a sommelier is the epitome? What is the sommelier's Super Bowl?
Well, you're talking about the Master Sommelier title and the Master of Wine title. Those are the two elite distinctions. It's a 2% pass rate on both. Consider them to be PhDs. There's actually a documentary coming out. They followed four individuals trying to pass the Master Sommelier exam. Two of them are good friends of mine. And the level of knowledge and dedication that it takes to pass these examinations is extremely high.
You're actually going after something like that.
I'm actually in the process of working in and passing both of them. And currently in the world, there's only three men.
Wow.
That have passed the entire, both of the distinctions, if you will.
So is that a group of letters that can follow your name on your business card, or do you get a blazer to wear, or what do you get?
There is a blazer.
Ah.
There's pins, but there is the title of holding an MSMW after your name.
Well, okay. Well, good luck with that. You've already answered this, I think, but my last question is, does wine have to be expensive to be good?
Not at all. The one thing that I love to do is I love to stump people. And I'll put a $10 bottle, a $100 bottle, and a $1,000 bottle in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll pour the glasses, and everything will be tasted blind. And you tell me what you think, the $10, the $100, and the $1,000. And most people cannot get that right.
It's a little bit superficial for people to think that they have to order a expensive bottle of wine to make an impression.
With some, you do.
Yeah.
For some business dinners, you'll find that. For some people going out on a first date.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, everyone just wants to drink great juice. At least that's what I've experienced here at Nattara.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good way to put it. How old does wine have to be good?
It can be as fresh as yesterday or as old as, you know, centuries old. There's no age, really.
Okay. I know my dad at one time was making wine at home. Dandelion wine he made once. Wow.
Oh, I've actually, you know, when I came back to Wisconsin fairly early on after getting into the wine business, everyone came out of the woodwork and brought me their homemade wine.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite an experience.
Well, I suppose, though, you've become very good at keeping your face normal. You don't cringe or pucker or maybe you
no.
do. I mean, you have to hide it, I suppose. It's diplomatic.
Well, when you're at tastings and the winemaker is right in front of you and you taste a wine and it's not to your liking,
mm-hmm.
Poker face comes into effect.
Yeah. And you have to keep from shuddering.
Because
that shudder goes...
Yeah. That's the time when you say thank you and you walk away.
Head to toe. I don't know where I'm coming up with these questions, but this is the last one, I promise. I brought up dandelion wine. What's the weirdest thing that you've ever heard wine being made out of?
I have to say dandelion wine is probably the most out there.
Unique?
The unique, yes, that I've ever tasted.
Okay. I suppose, you know, given all the technology and things out there and people's imaginations and the fact that all these vineyards are cropping up, there will be new strains of wine. People will say, I think you can make wine out of that.
Literally anything that has sugar can be converted.
Thanks for taking the time, and next time you're around, give me a holler and I'll buy you a spotted cow.
Oh, fantastic. We've got a deal now.
Good luck.
Thank you.
You can sense her exuberance with her vocation. It's refreshing, just like the liquids she knows so much about. Brooke Sobel, a UW Stout grad. I believe you'll be hearing more about that young lady. Hey, next week at UW Eau Claire, they'll be dancing. Concert by the Masters of Song. We'll say hello to Dolly as they are in Osseo and a couple folkies on stage together. Thanks to Wisconsin and Marquette for great basketball years. High school teams still in it. Go after the gold ball. Hope to see you in Alma on Sunday. You'll like the Big River Radio Wave. It's a lot of fun. Have a nice weekend, everybody. We'll be back next Friday.